Each month, the Security Ledger podcast informs and entertains an audience of thousands of technology and information security professionals. If that sounds like an audience your company is trying to reach, consider sponsoring one of our podcasts. We offer per-episode sponsorships of our weekly podcasts, which feature news, analysis, and discussion of the most important cybersecurity topics of the day. Or you can commission a custom podcast to highlight your executives, researchers, and subject matter experts. To learn more, point your web browser to securityledger.com/sponsor. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode of the podcast, number 203.
They're saying in these rooms that I get them in, like, hey, you know, this is not going to happen in the place that I'm at. And I trust their words and their intentions. But I, like I said, I feel like there's a gap in between them and how people, you know, come to them. I feel like the pre-screening videos, the ATS stuff, you know, all of that works with bias that's just built in to preclude African-American women and people from being in there.
Everybody decries the lack of diversity in the information security field, but is InfoSec's white male complexion a bug or a feature? In our second segment, we're joined by Tanisha Martin, the founder of Black Girls Hack, to talk about the many barriers that women of color face as they pursue positions in information security. But first, an obscure water treatment facility in Oldsmar, Florida, became ground zero for the United States' concerns about foreign adversaries' ability to access and control critical infrastructure. This after local officials last week revealed at a news conference that an unknown assailant had remotely accessed the facility's SCADA system and attempted to raise the levels of the chemical sodium hydroxide in the drinking water by a factor of more than 100. The attack failed after a worker at the treatment plant saw it play out in real time on his terminal and adjusted the sodium hydroxide levels back to normal. But closeies do count when it comes to critical infrastructure hacks, and the Oldsmar incident set off a federal investigation as well as a flurry of warnings about the risks facing critical infrastructure systems of all sorts now that so many workers are accessing them remotely during the COVID pandemic. In our first segment this week, we're joined by Frank Downs of the firm BlueVoyant to discuss the Oldsmar water system hack and why critical infrastructure firms continue to struggle to protect their environments.
My name is Frank Downs. I'm the director of proactive services at BlueVoyant. BlueVoyant is basically an end-to-end cybersecurity solution for organizations. Everything from MSS to proactive assessments and maturity assessments of an organization, we're able to walk organizations throughout their entire cybersecurity experience from beginning to end. At BlueVoyant, I assess organizations, giving them an understanding of their strategic level cybersecurity readiness, or cyber maturity, if you will.
We're here today to talk about the big news that broke with a news conference down in by the Pinellas County Sheriff in Florida, regarding an incident in Oldsmar, Florida, at a water treatment facility where a cyber intruder, apparently, remotely accessed critical infrastructure, industrial control system used to treat the water down there and increased the amount of poisonous chemical by, what was it, 11,000% or something
way,
like
way
that?
Way too much.
Way too much.
I think that's the scientific term.
Yeah. Which was basically the equivalent of like pouring Drano into the drinking water and then, you know, walking away. Not good. I think people were most freaked out by the idea that there was lye in their drinking water, but it's in very small quantities, very, very, very small quantities. And this is just part of water treatment. But give me your thoughts on this incident.
Well, I think it's pretty interesting, and it points out something that we're seeing a lot in critical infrastructure as well as SCADA systems. SCADA being shorthand for supervisory control and data acquisition systems. These are the types of networks that control things like water plants and, say, transportation infrastructures such as subways, monorails, trains, as well as things such as gas infrastructure. Now, what we mean by that is when you're at home or when you're at work, traditionally, 9 times out of 10, you have a network and it connects several different computers to make sure business operations occur. Well, not everyone has the type of business operation where it's, let's keep the lights on, let's keep the power on, let's keep, you know, the water moving and so forth. That's where these types of systems come in. Now, when you look at how these things were born, and we're saying we're looking way back at the 40s and 50s, for example, and 60s as well, and so on, you had the birth of these types of systems where you had pretty much a central hub, central location, and they would control all the different mechanisms that would provide water or provide power and so forth. The example I'll use is, you know, when you look at, if you saw that HBO series last year, Chernobyl, right? They had the big room and all the different systems were connected to just that big room. Well, it's very similar to how everything was in the past at any kind of power plant or any kind of transportation system and that, so forth, and water treatment or plants as well.
They're kind of self-contained entities, basically.
Exactly, they are. And that's the interesting thing. They're self-contained for a lot of reasons. One, these systems perform a very specific job, right? They just need to make sure the water's treated and goes and so forth, or, you know, the gas gets from point A to point B. And what happened is, as you saw the evolution of these systems and, you know, personal computing and business computing at the same time, you started to see the integration of both traditional computer systems and these SCADA and critical infrastructure systems. Now, what's interesting is you're then in the situation where you have certain systems that have never been connected to the internet for, like, let's say 30 years, for an example, all of a sudden they're connected. Right. And you have something that wasn't even necessarily built with the idea of the internet in mind, and they're connected. What you've seen, especially over the last 20 years, is the rise of what's called smart SCADA then. SCADA systems that are connected to the internet to provide additional functionality, such as remote connectivity for organizations. You don't have to be at a central command anymore. You don't have to be at a central operations center anymore. To ensure, which this hack illustrated.
Right.
To perform actions. Now, it's interesting and difficult, too, because you're connecting systems, as I mentioned, that never necessarily were built to with the idea of being connected to anything else but themselves. However, now you have these connections to bring them into the 21st century. Some systems are being brought into the 21st century better than others, right? Some are built from the ground up, but then you see SCADA instances where the example I'll use is Stuxnet from 2010-ish timeframe, where a nuclear reactor or a centrifuge was taken advantage of through an advanced persistent threat actor.
Yeah, uranium enrichment facility in Iran. Yeah,
Iran. Correct. Often, when you see a type of attack against some type of SCADA system, it has to be a very specifically crafted piece of code, right? Because you're talking about working with systems that don't necessarily have internet connectivity as their primary function. And you have systems that are one of a kind. So, for example, in, we'll say, the centrifugal instance, they probably had to craft something that was specifically coded for the centrifuges. What we saw here in Florida was different. What we saw here in Florida was something that took advantage of an application that is on many, many systems throughout all types of business operations in the world. And that's specifically a program called TeamViewer. What TeamViewer allows is it makes remote connectivity incredibly easy. You can simply have it installed on one system and on another system. And from any from one system, you can control another system. Now, this was being used in the Florida instance because there would be remote connectivity from different employees for the water treatment plant. Managers, for example, that would connect and then would do certain water actions if they weren't on site, or if, for example, there was a problem and IT needed to log in. And in fact, this is often by IT. However, it was then, in this instance, subverted by some type of malicious actor to then gain access and dump a great deal of lie in there.
And would you need to, I would think that you would need to authenticate as somebody trying to do a remote session to the system you're controlling. That would almost certainly be the case, but I don't know if that was the case here, or if there was already a TeamViewer session active and therefore he just kind of jumped on top of it. I don't know.
That's interesting. They haven't discussed it to that level of detail so far. What they have mentioned is that the technician at first saw that the mouse was moving around and said, oh, okay, well, someone's remoted into the system and is doing a few things. He thought it was the normal traditional operating. However, later, when the technician was actually performing actions and the mouse was continuing to move, that's when they knew something was up. So, yes, I mean, you bring up a valid point there, right?
Yeah. Where do we start here, Frank? So first of all, one of the things that I'm not clear on, and I don't think anyone is here, is it was TeamViewer actually deployed software, or was it Shadow IT? Was it a tool that was useful, especially in these, you know, kind of pandemic times as people were working from home, that basically got rolled out without any official sanction? Or was it officially sanctioned and monitored by the IT group and so on and just used, you know, used within the organization? So I'm not sure. I don't know if you know, but it's not clear to me that it was sanctioned software, even though it clearly was being used.
I love that question, Paul, because I love whenever anyone brings up Shadow IT, right?
Yep.
Because, and by the way, I'll say, I don't know, but I have my suspicions. And I'll tell you why. I think that it was something that was actually permitted by the organization to be, and I only say that because they brought it up in the actual release, that they've made that fact public. Okay. If I was leveraging some type of unapproved application and it was some type of Shadow IT, I wouldn't necessarily want to bring it up, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So the fact that they disclosed that TeamViewer was the vector of attack would suggest that it was sanctioned software. I would agree with you.
That's the takeaway I would have from it.
Yeah. Yep.
But that's not to say that it necessarily wasn't. It's just the way they described the use of it and the fact that they released that, I'd say it probably was.
Well, if it wasn't sanctioned before, it definitely is sanctioned now.
Yeah. The first thing management did was probably sanction it to say, oh man, this is not us. Woo.
Yeah. So a couple other things, and I'd be interested in your perspective on this. A couple other things. First of all, you would think you would want some kind of two-factor authentication around those TeamViewer sessions, again, just to make sure that it's actually the human associated with your organization who is connecting. You know, so give, you know, send it to their phone or what have you. Make them generate a second factor. You know, so you know it's them.
Oh, yeah.
The other is that you would think there would be some protocols around remote sessions, right? So if somebody who is remote needs to drive, that there would be, you know, almost like, you know, people in a submarine or a bomber or something sort of saying, okay, I'm taking the controls now, you know, step aside.
Yeah, definitely. I like that you put two parts there. I always love multi-factor authentication. Well, I mean, no one loves it, right? No one's like, all right, I can't wait to do more to get in. But it really provides me a level of confidence when I'm working with different clients on site, understanding that they have multi-factor authentication. Because, and I'll be honest, Paul, it's saved my bacon more than once too.
Me too.
Right when I get that notification that hey, here's your code, and I was like, I did not just try to log in.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's
trying to log into Facebook from, you know, New York City or, you know, wherever, and you're like, oh, that ain't me,
that's not me, nope,
yeah, yep. Now I'm going to change my, I'm going to update my password, right? Yeah,
the one that really got me the other day, it was 2 weeks ago, was my LastPass one, and that's. Uh-huh. Yeah, and I was like, okay, I really need this one to not be compromised. So I'm really glad I'm multi-factor there. I'm definitely a fan of multi-factor. But then I also like that you brought up protocol, because we can use protocol in both instances here, right? Because clearly the protocol affiliated with TeamViewer was approved and with the firewall rules, no matter where they had them, and was allowed to come through. So from that level, the protocol was clearly approved, whether they knew it or not. But also as far as the protocol and maybe governance around it, right? Was it approved? What are the mechanisms for a TeamViewer session to log in and remotely control these important water systems? Who has to call who, right? Where's the bat phone, right? Has it run? Things along those lines. And I'm not necessarily sure that those were in place based upon what we've heard from the technicians so far. When they came in the first time and saw it moving around, they just, assumed, right? Yeah. Maybe not. Maybe that's not good that you just be assume. You should know.
That's what I thought as well. Like, okay, that in and of itself is a little worrying, because it suggests that people are kind of loose and wild within this organization. You know, sometime you're working and a manager's over, you know, taking control of your system to do stuff. And it's sort of like, well, that sounds sloppy.
Yeah, but, not sloppy, but stressful. I mean,
if you've got
at any time, like, and I've worked for those types of organizations where, you know, a big sticker on the top of the monitor says, use of this system constitutes consent to monitoring, right? Very stressful times on those systems. Even though I didn't do anything suspicious, it's like, okay, I hope I'm typing the right keys now, guys, who are watching, right?
So, as you guys work with companies, I mean, is TeamViewer, these types of, and there are many of these remote access tools. I mean, obviously Citrix and RDP and so on. I mean, there are a lot. There's a Chrome viewer, Google has a Chrome viewer. Is it common that you see these employed within organizations, particularly in sensitive verticals like critical infrastructure? And how well are companies accounting for the added risk of using them?
I would say that yes. It depends. You don't see them so much on small mom and pop organizations, because usually it's just they shout down the hall and IT shows up, right? Also, my wife works in education, and they never do this with education. They just have to wait till every third Tuesday of the month when the IT tech is at their school to then hope that their ticket will be one of the ones that are answered. Let's talk about stuff.
I'm on my town's IT advisory committee, so
So you know, it's rough. Yeah. But what I've seen it most used in is when organizations and companies cross about the 80 person mark, and especially when the type of work that they do is distributed either nationally or internationally across multi-site work. And in those instances, you'll see a solution such as this crop up. And, they're pretty prevalent, because it gets to the point where it's just not technically feasible or personally feasible. I mean, we can't send an IT tech to all the different sites all the time to do different things, right? There has to be this remote access type of solution. Now, whenever I do see it, that's one of the first things that once I see it, that goes to the top of the list as far as prioritization for assessing the controls surrounding it, right? If those are subverted, those can be a very, very vicious exploitation. However, they've become something that is almost a requisite for most organizations, something that, because let's be honest, when you're doing IT, it's a lot easier sometimes just to say, here, let me drive. We'll get this done in 5 minutes rather than the 25 minutes it'll take if I try to get you to do this over the phone. So, yes, they are pretty prevalent. And with the day and age that we live in, I think they'll only become more prevalent. The key to that is implementing them in a smart, considerate fashion, ensuring that you have the right controls in place. Oh, totally. Totally. Just like everything else. And it depends on which one you select and so forth. You can enable multi-factor authentication. Right. You can put in different elements of governance to ensure that they're only used at certain times in certain places in certain ways. Paul, there's a lot of different ways to keep an eye on this type of activity to make sure that it is, for example, behavioral analysis and heuristics. Right. If you take a look and all of a sudden someone's connecting at the same time at 9 p.m. Let's say 1 a.m. when everyone's asleep, that's suspicious stuff. I would be really interested in seeing how the system itself was exploited. Just because TeamViewer was the thing that was taken advantage of doesn't necessarily mean it was the application that was exploited in the first place.
So, I mean, there's been a lot of, ink spilled at the federal level and guidance from CISA and others on to critical infrastructure verticals and companies around these types of threats. This, unfortunately, makes me feel like maybe those messages or those warnings or advice haven't really been heeded. Why do you think that is, and what can we do to actually get some of these, small critical infrastructure providers, don't feel like they're a big target because they're just little old, water treatment plant in some small town to take the threat seriously?
What you're starting to see is that there's been a shift over the last, I'd say, especially 2 to 3 years within cybersecurity, where organizations are realizing just because they haven't been hacked doesn't mean they won't be hacked. So they're starting to take proactive measures, right? However, the issue is we still have this problem within cybersecurity where the talent gap is immense, Paul. And I'm talking, it's getting bigger and bigger every day. We've got several studies out that show, on average, trying to fill a cybersecurity position can take, if you're lucky, 3 to 6 months to fill a cybersecurity position on your own staff to shore up your capabilities. And then there is about a 50-50 chance that person can actually do the job out the gate without any additional training. Furthermore, once you actually have them, you have to hope that the other organizations within your industry don't suddenly just steal them by offering to pay them more. So it's not so much that these organizations don't know that there's an issue, it's that they're having a hard time getting the solutions.
Your background's in the intelligence community. What in your mind is going to be the official response to this? I'm guessing, you know, FBI will be involved in the investigation of this. It seems kind of ham-fisted. It doesn't seem like a particularly sophisticated effort to manipulate a water treatment facility. But nevertheless, they did. And so what do you think the official response will be? And do you think any changes at the policy level may result from this?
First, I think the FBI getting involved is the appropriate organization and agency to do so. And I believe they already are involved. Because as you mentioned, this does seem rather ham-fisted. For example, I do not think it was pretty evident this was not an advance. Well, okay. I'm never going to say never. All right.
Hey, what is a mouse moving around? Yeah, that doesn't sound like it.
This doesn't smell like an APT attack, right? And those APT attacks, usually you don't even know something's happened until it's over.
Yeah.
But case in point, SolarWinds had a really good run there until it was finally caught. So as a result, I think especially the FBI has a lot of experience in this. As far as policy goes, I think in this specific instance, the big thing that you'll see is there's definitely going to be policy changes in Florida, right? There's clearly going to be policy changes in Florida. As far as a national change and so forth, I don't know. It'll be very interesting. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on the lawmakers' agendas right now, as you're probably aware, at a national level.
Yeah. They're kind of busy.
It's a little concerning because timing is everything, right? And yeah. I think the timing in this instance is it may fall through the cracks, but yeah. I can hope that it doesn't.
Well, I mean, one of the challenges we have in this country is so much of our critical infrastructure is privately owned and operated, and it is a fairly decentralized system.
And that's a great way of putting it, because it is. And then you have CISA, which is a great agency, and thankfully is getting shored up, actually. Announcements that they're going to have more funding and greater investment, and you can hope that they'll be able to bring everything to the table that they can. However, I think you're right; it is going to be a bit of a herding cats kind of scenario. And when you bring up a valid point, with so much of this being privately owned, sadly, it may end up taking the form of nothing will change until the bottom line is really impacted, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a little disgusting, because that means usually in situations like that, the bottom line is only impacted when people get hurt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lawsuits or I guess maybe regulations, but
both,
or both, right? Yeah. Frank Downs of BlueVoyant, thank you for coming on and speaking to us on Security Ledger podcast.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a blast.
We'll stay in touch. Up next, for years, professionals have decried the lack of diversity in the information security field, which, even more than high tech in general, is dominated by white men. At InfoSec conferences, concerted effort has been made to give more visibility and voice to women and minorities. The dreaded MANLs, panels made up entirely of men, have been targeted and in many cases banished. But down in the trenches where information hiring takes place and information security work is done, there is less evidence of change. The lack of progress, despite a crushing shortage of information security workers in the U.S. and the stated intentions of industry leaders and executives, might get you wondering whether cybersecurity's lack of diversity is a bug or a feature of the system. Our next guest suggests that it may be a feature indeed. Tanisha Martin is the founder of Black Girls Hack, a group that looks to promote women of color in cybersecurity. In this conversation, Tanisha and I talk about the many large and small obstacles that keep women like herself from pursuing cybersecurity careers, from inequalities at the K-12 level to pricey certifications and acronym-stuffed job requirements for would-be information security professionals. Solving those problems, Tanisha says, is going to take a lot more than kind words and good intentions from InfoSec leaders. To start off, I asked Tanisha to tell us a little bit about her organization.
I'm Tanisha Martin, the Executive Director for Black Girls Hack.
Tanisha, welcome to Security Ledger Podcast.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you guys for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you. I think the first order of business is this group that you helped establish, Black Girls Hack, and kind of what your mission is and what you do. Just tell us a little bit about that group.
So as I said, I'm the executive director for Black Girls Hack. It's a nonprofit organization that's set up to help get Black women into cybersecurity and into the executive suites. So we try to provide mentoring, hands-on training, study groups, pretty much anything that we see as a barrier for entry into the cybersecurity field.
And how long have you been around? How long has Black Girls Hack been a thing?
So Black Girls Hack started as an Instagram page in May of 2019. And it was just intended to kind of share resources, training, and information about, you know, how to get into cyber. And they, it kind of morphed from there into this thing where, you know, now we're offering study groups that are instructor led. We're strategically planning different ways that we can interact with corporate partners to be able to provide resources for our organizations, as well as like hands-on skills and classes. So we filed our paperwork for nonprofit in September of last year, and we filed the IRS papers for 501c3 in November of last year. So, you know, at this point, we're just trying to get more exposure so that we can get additional partners that can help to fulfill our mission.
You know, underlying this is obviously a huge diversity problem in the information security field. Despite the fact that the information security field is booming right now and there is a lot of work to be done. But and your group addresses basically two big diversity problems that InfoSec has. One is women and the other is people of color. You have data on your website, and I think it accords with what I've read elsewhere. You know, 7.5% of information security professionals are African-American and only 17% women, despite the fact that, you know, women are 51% of the population and African-Americans are definitely more than 7.5% of the general population. So I guess the first question is, as your group sees it, what are the sources of that disparity? And, you know, what's the best way to address it?
So I think that one of the biggest issues that we see in the industry today is bias. So we see that bias in algorithms. We see it that from, like, for example, the automated talent screening systems and pre-screening videos. You know, there have been studies that have shown that they don't pick up, for example, African-American micro expressions or features as well as they should. So there's a lot of bias developed in these types of systems. So, you know, as part of the, I call it gatekeepers into cybersecurity, you see, for example, like the automated talent screening systems, which, you know, filter through resumes in order to get them through to the hiring managers. So, you know, yeah. We do a lot of talks on Black Girls Hack on Clubhouse in various rooms about the issues that are facing cybersecurity professionals, Black people who are in cybersecurity, and specifically on Wednesday nights, we do a talk about women in cybersecurity and the issues affecting us. And, you know, there is, you know, really no diversity in the hiring suites. You know, people tend to hire people who are reflective of them, of themselves. So it's like, you know, if we get more people of color, we get more women of color into the environments, then, you know, we can start to make changes so that the next generation of cybersecurity professionals, which we're trying to prepare, are able to get into the industry. Some of the other issues are, for example, you see directly into the job requisitions, you know, you needing 3 to 5 years of experience in a CISSP for an entry level position, you know, which doesn't make sense because CISSP requires at least 5 years of professional experience as well as a sponsor. So if you're new to cybersecurity and, you know, you've been in maybe a year or, you know, maybe just starting because you're transitioning from another industry, it's very hard to, you know, be able to convince yourself to get over some of the like imposter syndrome type things to apply for these positions. But then when you have to go through, for example, like the ATS system and pre-screening videos, you know, it kind of like reduces the number of Black faces that you see actually making it through to the job. So, I mean, I think some of the things that I would like to see are changes, more diversity initiatives in organizations to hire. If they can do like some kind of training programs, for example, internships, we have literally got, you know, probably 50 to 100 people who are, you know, entry level, maybe 1 or 2 years of experience who are looking to supplement the hands-on experience they're getting through Black Girls Hack, and to be able to, you know, turn it into some actual work experience. So, you know, just programs that are set up to pull people like that, you know, from HBCUs or even people mm-hmm. who didn't, you know, go to HBCUs. Like, you know, we have a lot of people who are trying to get into the field, and, you know, the news would have you believe that there's, you know, no unemployment in cybersecurity. Okay. But mm-hmm. you see, you know, I think it's something like 3 million jobs worldwide that are open in cybersecurity. I think they said 500,000 of those are specifically in the United States. But like, I know that I interface with, you know, hundreds of men and women who are trying to get into cybersecurity and, you know, want the opportunity, but just can't find a way to get their foot in the door. So
talk just a little bit about who you have on your team at Black Girls Hack and the you know, the different folks in your organization and some of the things that you've accomplished just in the last 2 years.
Sure. So one of the, I guess, most recent accomplishments that we had is that we came in place in the Black and Cyber Winter Conference Capture the Flag competition. That was a really big deal. That was one of the, you know, few CTF competitions that we've played in. So, you know, for us to come in second, I felt like was, you know, really big deal. We recently just graduated, I think somewhere between 60 to 70 Security Plus students from our first cohort who are gearing up to take the Security Plus exam. So we're trying to reach out to various partners to try to help us get them, you know, vouchers at $350. The Security Plus is, you know, a foundation level exam, but, you know, that's a big reach for, you know, some folks who are having a hard time just, you know, trying to make it day to day, you know. Underemployed, out of employment, whatever the situation may be. So we're trying to get, like I said, the partners to try to help us on that front. We've had our members take their hands-on skills that they've learned in our, you know, in our workshops, which we offer up on Meetup, into professional jobs. One of the squad, I like to call them our squad, because, you know, they're not really kids or, you know, they're not all adults. But one of them just got hired into FireEye. Which I thought was super cool. Yeah. So, you know, we're having our members be able to articulate themselves and the work they're doing in their home labs so that they can, you know, take those to the hiring manager. So we've also had exposure for tens of students in Try Hack Me and Hack the Box, and they're getting some hands-on penetration testing experience. And we've probably had like, you know, 50 to 70 students set up home labs so they can practice their hands-on skills. So when we first started, you know, it was just basically me, and I was doing all of the workshops, and I was kind of like limited as to what I could teach them because I can only teach them what I know. And I don't even consider myself, you know, for example, a cybersecurity SME. You know, I'd say I'm relatively new into the industry. So, you know, but as much as I know, you know, I want to give to them, but, you know, we've recently expanded. I think we have maybe 20 to 25 volunteers for the organization now. Some of those folks have taken on some of those other workshops so that, you know, I can focus more on the strategic planning, you know, for the organization moving forward. Because, you know, I feel like we have really great ideas to try to get the cybersecurity professionals into, you know, these jobs. So we just need help. So
And the group's called Black Girls Hack, but of course, as you said, you serve women as well. I mean, what are the age groups generally that your programs reach out to?
So we've got people as young as maybe like 14 or 15 who join some of our things, and as old as, you know, maybe their 50s, not 60s.
Mid-career.
Mid-career folks who are trying to get into cybersecurity. One of the main things that ties all of these folks together is that they are relatively new to the cybersecurity field. They see it as a booming industry moving forward, and they want to be able to get into the industry. So, you know, we provide, like I said, the hands-on skills, the training as much as we can to the squad just so they can be able to, you know, get these skills so that they can be able to articulate them. You know, I've been working on mock interviews for them and, you know, looking at resumes, reviews, and LinkedIn, you know, so that we can make sure that they present as the, you know, complete package and they can, you know, appropriately articulate what it is that they're trying to do, you know, because for some folks, it's just an issue of, you know, not being confident enough in themselves and their skills to be able to, you know, say, hey, I've got experience in this, you know, I've got 15 years of project management experience. You know, you have to, you know, not assume that you have to start from zero just because you're moving from, say, finance or healthcare into cybersecurity.
Right. Yeah. In some ways, I think the media depiction of cybersecurity work is probably discouraging. You know, it's kind of like the Mr. Robot type. You know, you've got to have like a hoodie and your fingers are like flying over the keyboard and like, you know, you're this kind of savant, you know, cybersecurity person. But of course, as you know, like, you know, the industry needs all different types of skill sets and there are all different types of work, right?
Oh, definitely. Like, my husband actually had this conversation with our doctor the other day. He was wearing a Black Girls Hack hoodie. And she thought it must be like a pun or it must be something different. Because in her mind, a hacker has a negative connotation. You know, it wasn't something to be celebrated. It wasn't something to, you know, be excited about doing, you know. And then when he explained to her what it is that we do, you know, how we operate with permission, how we, you know, help to make organizations more secure, how we determine vulnerabilities in computer systems so that organizations can keep their data safer. You know, then she understood that, you know, it actually is something to be celebrated. It is something that is not, you know, like you said, like the hacker, the hooded feature in the dark, you know, typing away on a lit up keyboard, you know, it's something that could be done in the light.
So, Sinesha, can we talk about your path to info security and kind of how you got your start? Because I'm guessing it's probably, you know, illustrative of, you know, a path that others might follow. So how do you get into it?
Actually, my own experiences are kind of what led me to start Black Girls Hack. So I've been an IT consultant for the DoD for, you know, I think probably over 15 years at this point. I've been doing everything from risk to information assurance, quality assurance, auditing. And, you know, I started reaching out probably about, you know, 5 years ago, if not more, to my organization's leadership and telling them like, hey, you know, I'm interested in moving into a more cybersecurity role. And, you know, I was finding a lot of, you know, barriers to entry, you know, some of the things that we talked about. And so, you know, they're willing to, for example, reimburse me for certifications. But, you know, that's not going to do anything for me if, you know, I'm not being considered for jobs that are in the cybersecurity field. You know, I can't tell you how many jobs I've applied to both, you know, within my organization as well as outside. And I do not, like, it's literally crickets. I do not hear anything back. And, you know, just for a little bit of context, like, I've literally got, I think, 5 master's degrees at this point. I have gone to some of the most prestigious schools in the country. I'm an alumna of Johns Hopkins University and Carnegie Mellon University, as well as the University of Maryland. And literally, I cannot get, you know, could not get folks to give me a call back, you know, because if it's like, hey, we want to see that you've got more hands-on experience, or hey, we want to see this, you know, a lot of the things that I've experienced, I've seen firsthand. And so I also see that in the squad, you know, as they tell me their stories and what it is they're trying to do. But I feel like they're pretty consistent across the industry. But like I said, some things that we can do something about, you know, we can make people more prepared for interviews. We can make people more prepared for hands-on tasks that they want you to do to show that you can, you know, be able to do the job. We can make people prepared for those types of things. But, you know, I can't do anything about the automatic talent screening systems. I can't do anything about like the bias in the industry. You know, I've seen some press recently about how some, you know, pretty major organizations put out publications that said that they didn't think that people from certain schools had the appropriate amount of programming knowledge to be able to compete in their organizations. And I feel like that kind of bias, you know, whether it's written or just in the culture of the organization, is part of the problem. You know, there's so many things that need to be looked at, you know, just to increase diversity in cybersecurity and the executive suites. And I'm trying to focus on the things that I can, you know, as far as providing this training, the certifications, the hands-on skills, the, you know, coaching, things of that nature. But the other things that I can't do, you know, I'm not in the executive suites in Fortune companies. I'm not, you know, a part of their diversity conversations and about how they go about getting a more more parity in their hiring. You know, like you mentioned before, you know, women represent something like 17 to 20% in the latest statistics that came out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, whereas we represent 51% of the United States. You know, why is there not more parity both in the field?
And an even higher percentage of people with advanced, with college degrees.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, the numbers get even more absurd when you start looking at that. Yeah.
Yeah, I was actually on a call last week with someone who's looking into partnering with our organization. And I had one of the people in their company on the call with me. And, you know, she was saying, hey, I've got a master's degree in cybersecurity. You know, I'm trying to find a job within the organization and I can't get in there. So, you know, it's good that you're saying that you want to make changes, but, you know, kind of be the change that you want to see.
I mean, it seems to me too, like, you know, you mentioned the C-suite, and my guess is these days, you know, the C-suite is going to say a lot of right sounding things about the need for diversity within their organizations and their commitment to diversity. But, you know, as you talk about it, what really strikes me is, you know, ultimately it comes down to the decision of that person far below the C-suite who's sitting across the interview desk from you and whose decision it is basically what kind of quote unquote candidate they're looking for. And that a lot of the no's that you're getting might be because in their mind, you know, you don't look like the part, you know, you don't have a beard, you don't have a sleeve tat, you know, you're not wearing a hoodie or whatever, like whatever their mental image is, like you don't fit it, regardless of your skills, qualifications, degrees, and all this other stuff, right?
Yes. I definitely agree. I think that there's a huge gap. And if I had to tell you where exactly it is in the process, I'd say somewhere between the hiring managers and the HR. I absolutely love HR. I'm not intending to vilify them in any way. But I think that, you know, from when the hiring managers put out what it is that they need, and then, you know, HR adds whatever else is required for, you know, maybe that industry or that role, you start to see some of the, I feel like, ridiculous things that we see, such as, you know, 3 to 5 years of experience for an entry level job, you know, and a CISSP, which is an advanced level certification for managers, for an entry level job. It's like, you want to call someone a junior something and require that they have a CISSP just seems absolutely ridiculous to me. You know, so they're saying in these rooms that I get them in, like, hey, you know, this is not going to happen in the place that I'm at. And I trust their words and their intentions. But I, like I said, I feel like there's a gap in between them and, you know, how people, you know, come to them. You know, I feel like the pre-screening videos, the ATS stuff, you know, all of that works with bias that's just built in to preclude African-American women and people from, you know, being in there. And it's not just an issue that's isolated to, you know, just women or, you know, just African-Americans. I think it's, you know, anyone who is not the predominant, you know, white male, you know, older demographics.
Can you think of like experiences you've had in interviews that kind of typify some of the challenges or kind of just the kind of what you're up against as a woman applying for a cybersecurity job and also as a minority applying for a cybersecurity job?
I've said some of the things that I've, issues that I've faced is, you know, just bias in the types of questions that they ask. You know, I am from Washington, D.C. So I went to D.C. public school. So, you know, we did not have, you know, textbooks for everybody in the class. We had maybe 30 people in the class, 15 books, right? You know, you had to share. We didn't have advanced level calculus courses. So, you know, it's like you expect, you know, once they've graduated from DC public schools to then go to college and be able to pass, you know, I think we had something like maybe 6 calculus level classes that we had to pass. And it's just like, well, how do you expect us to be able to succeed, you know, when we're not even getting the same type of pre-exposure as some of our peers, you know, and we face those same type of issues in the job, you know, in the job process. You know, they're saying, hey, do you have any hands-on experience, you know, doing this ethical hacking and penetration testing? And, you know, I tell folks, you know, I do not. You know, I've literally been in the same place for the past 9 years where I've been trying to, you know, get into cybersecurity. But at this time, you know, I've won capture the flag competitions. Like I've placed well in them. I've taught a whole lot of other people how to, you know, get into the industry, but you know, like I don't have the hands-on experience, you know, so I'm not getting hired for any of those types of jobs at this point. That's why I said, I think if I had to pinpoint the point in the process where there's a holdup, like I said, I think it's between the hiring managers and then what actually gets put out, you know, into the job recs that make it online. And I think the other issue, and it's not so much their issue as much as it is ours, is that like I've noticed that, you know, men and women who have, you know, similar skills will look at a job rec and a man will say, you know, hey, I've got, you know, maybe 50% of these requirements I'm going to apply anyway, right? Whereas a woman will look at the same rec with the same experience and say, hey, I don't meet these, so I'm not even going to bother applying for the job, you know?
Well, a woman will say, I only have 80% of these, so I shouldn't apply because I don't have 100% of them, right?
Exactly. And I tell folks all the time, especially my mentees, that if you meet 100% of the job requisitions requirements, then that is definitely not the job for you. You want to be able to grow within your position. You want to be able to grow within your organization and be able to add value. So if you come into the job knowing how to do everything that, you know, that the job requires, then you're going to, you know, quickly find yourself hitting the ceiling and just saying, hey, you know, like, how am I supposed to grow? How am I supposed to gain additional skills? How am I supposed to learn, you know, from this experience? Because you've got everything. So, you know, I tell people all the time, you know, hey, even if you're only hitting, you know, 50, 60% of the things, especially women, you know, go ahead and apply. You know, go, and the worst they can do is say no, you know, and that's kind of like my unofficial mantra is, you know, ask the question, put it out there, and see if they say no. You know, so many times, like I've put out requests, for things on Twitter, for example, where I'm saying, hey, someone in the squad really just needs to talk to somebody in threat. And I'll put a request out and then, you know, these amazing people who I don't know will reach out to me and say, hey, send them my way, you know, let them ask the questions, you know, because again, we need representation. We need, you know, people who that we can ask for direction and like, you know, what's the best thing that for me to do if I specifically want to go into, you know, incident response or threat hunting, you know, like, you know, so we need people to volunteer and to mentor so that, you know, we can have, you know, the appropriate direction, you know, not just people who are out here getting every certification and doing all of the degrees and, you know, doing everything to try to get into the job and then still not getting into, you know, to see a hiring manager. So.
Well, you bring up so many good points, Tanisha. One of course is just the problem with K-12, right? That these problems, like if you don't have a top, you know, if you're not in a top quality, you know, school district, then you're already at a disadvantage just going into, you know, post, you know, associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, whatever you're pursuing, gets that much harder if you haven't had it in K-12. The other that I think is really interesting that I hadn't thought about either was just the financial barriers to some of the certifications that are perceived as being needed to apply for the jobs, right? That there's this kind of gatekeeping going on, you know, where you need, you know, this certificate or it's perceived that you need this certificate. And that's turning people away, people who we need, right?
I definitely agree with that. Just on the topic of the financial barriers, like an entry level certification like Security Plus is $350. The Certified Ethical Hacking, which is like one of the, you know, more entry level certifications, is $1,300 to take, you know. So if people are, you know, and they expect you to have, you know, just as a foundation, a Security Plus and a CEH, if you're trying to get a junior pen testing job, you know, we're talking $1,500, you know, not to mention the, you know, the additional cost of having a hands-on lab or, you know, whatever it is that you had to do to prepare to get there. You know, those are steep hurdles for people to, you know, have to go get over. And then, you know, as far as the K-12 is concerned, you know, I see that as well. You see so many times that, you know, people are not, when you look at the statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you see that, you know, people who are getting into undergraduate degrees in STEM fields are not making it to the fields in graduate school. They're not actually even working in the industry. So I feel like, you know, in order for us to get more people into this, and I'm looking at this, you know, long term, not just, you know, next year or within the next 5 years. You know, we're rolling out a Black Kids Hack program this summer, which is basically going to be focused on, you know, the K-12 population and providing them with an introduction to cybersecurity and into, you know, hacking specifically, because we see that kids who have exposure to STEM at an early age are able to make significant contributions from society. You know, in Black History Month, we've been doing all month is, you know, showcasing Black men, women, and children who, through early exposure to STEM, have been able to make significant contributions to society. You know, some of the things that you probably don't even think about. And if these people were just, you know, aware that hacking is an option for them, you know, that there's no negative connotation, that we need people to try to keep organizations safe, then, you know, we would get more people into the field long term. And then, you know, combined with getting more Black women, you know, into the executive suites, getting more diversity into organizations, we can start to see over the course of the next generation changes that, you know, where we have parity as far as the number of, you know, Black people in the industry and the number of women in the industry, so that they actually feel, you know, get there and also feel comfortable being there once they're there.
Yeah. Because that's not, I mean, I'm sure you've been to an information security show, like that is not where we are right now. If you look at, if you look at the community, it is not representative of what the country looks like.
And I've actually gotten a chance to go to see a lot more conferences this year that I wouldn't have been able to go to otherwise, because, you know, they're typically, you know, thousands of dollars. So they've been virtual and free, you know, which is right in my price range. And so when you look at the people who are up there speaking, you know, they're mostly white men. You know, you don't see a lot of diversity in there. So, you know, these are the people who are influencing the next generation of up and coming hackers, you know, and they don't see, like I said, representation matters. They don't see, you know, Black women, Black men up there who are giving these talks, you know, and I don't think it's an issue that, you know, we don't have anything to talk about. You know, I just think it's a fact that, you know, we're not targeted when they're putting out the call for papers or the call for speakers. You know, we're not included in those types of events. So, you know, recently people have been reaching out to me, you know, in my position for Black Girls Hack and saying, hey, you know, can you come and talk here or can you do this? And I take every one of those opportunities because, like, I want to be able to tell people about the work that Black Girls Hack is doing, and also to get more, you know, color into these rooms so that people can see that there are actually Black people who are doing this. You know, I hate to perpetuate like stereotypes, but, you know, we see people so often in entertainment and in sports, but, you know, we also want to see them in STEM. We also want to see them in cybersecurity, you know? Marcus J. Carey is one of the folks that I follow. He's in the Tribe of Hackers, and he's a big inspiration to me, you know, just because he is, you know, one of the, you know, people to look up to in the industry, you know? We need that kind of inspiration, the representation, to just be able to see people who are like us so that we can know, you know, just provide the confidence that we can get in there and do it too.
So, you know, there are a lot of cybersecurity companies now. Many of them are very wealthy. What more can they be doing to, I don't even want to say increase diversity, but actually to concretely help the types of folks who your group is helping? Like what are some things, what types of resources could they help bring to bear that would make your job easier?
So I would appreciate like if they were to, for example, you know, develop initiatives to increase diversity into cyber. You know, for example, you know, their internships programs that they have set up, you know, a lot of these job recs will say specifically that they want to see people coming out of, you know, Hopkins, or they want to see people coming out of Carnegie Mellon. But, you know, what about the people who are coming out of the other schools? You know, you shouldn't have to, you know, be from a school that you probably wouldn't even be able to afford in order to get a job. I've been seeing that a lot lately, that they want you to come from top institutions and be, you know, have all of these requirements. And, you know, like, what about the other people who maybe couldn't afford that, but, you know, still worked really hard and are dope developers, are dope hackers, are dope, you know, people. So it's increasing diversity in cybersecurity, in cybersecurity. Also increasing representation. You know, there is an untapped market. We've literally got hundreds. Some of the other Black cybersecurity organizations that I'm familiar with, they also have, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people who are trying to, you know, do things in cybersecurity and just need, you know, opportunities.
And the big payoff for us as a society, I think, also is that it makes us more secure, not only because we have more people to do cybersecurity work, but also because you have more and different sets of eyes looking at cybersecurity problems, right? That one of the problems with having a totally homogenous population is that you're blind, is that you are blinded by, you know, perspectives and patterns of thinking that may cause you to miss important things, right?
Yeah, I definitely agree that, like I said, that bias that, you know, these algorithms are basically learning the behavior just based off of the people, the data that's being fed to them. You know, that data is representative of, you know, the group of people that are currently in place, you know, then you don't have any other views, you don't have any other perspectives. And, you know, I don't even really think that people are intending to have bias. It's really a lot of unconscious bias that gets built in that may not even be intended. So, you know, I definitely think that, you know, having more diversity, even, you know, as early as, you know, the development of the software and the development of these algorithms, you know, are going to definitely help to improve things moving forward.
Tanisha Martin from Black Girls Hack, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on Security Ledger Podcast. It's been great talking to you.
You too. I appreciate you for having us. And, you know, anytime you want to have any conversations, just let me know. It's been a great conversation.
Absolutely.